and even your own personal stories and connections to the music.
It's the ultimate musical hive mind.
Whatever you're doing, make great music part of your morning.
Essential Classics with me, Georgia Mann.
And me, Tom McKinney. Every weekday from 9 till noon on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
It's midday and time for Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest is the writer James Runcie.
Sometimes a musical work of art is just so perfect, so magnificent, that it's almost impossible to remember the sheer work that's gone on behind the scenes, from the early drafts to the anxiety and relief of the first performance. That's certainly true of a masterpiece like the Bach St. Matthew Passion. But my guest today, James Runcie, wants us to think about what went on in Bach's mind while he was creating that magnificent passion. And he's written both a play and a novel about it. The novel, his 12th, is called The Great Passion, and it was published earlier this year. You might have heard the play on Radio 4 just before Easter. James is an award-winning filmmaker, a playwright, and artistic director. He's worked at the BBC, the Bath Literary Festival, and the South Bank Centre. He's also the author of the Grantchester detective novels, now filming their 8th series for television. The hero is a young priest who solves crimes while wrestling with problems of religious faith. And religion is something James Runcie certainly knows all about, as his father, Robert, was Archbishop of Canterbury. Being the son of an archbishop is something to live down, I imagine.
There are complicated areas. being the son of a priest or the daughter of a priest is quite complicated because of the expectations upon you to behave well and the idea that you will be the same kind of moral exemplar as your parents. And, of course, the tendency then is to rebel and behave extremely badly. I think I've managed to do both, but the sense of the sacred, the sense of life beyond this one. I mean, there are all sorts of issues, but the idea that this world is transient is one of the most common things, I think. This idea that we are only here for a short while, it brings it into sharp relief when so many services are about the rites of passage of birth, marriage, and death.
Well, we'll come back to your relationship with your father in due course, but looking at your music list, I can see you love Schubert, Purcell, Ella Fitzgerald, and of course, I'm not surprised to see that it's dominated by Bach, God to some of us. We're going to hear three pieces by Bach today. What have you chosen to begin with?
Well, I've chosen Cantata 51, partly because it's the thing that I first heard that gave me an idea of sheer, exuberant, exhilarating joy. And I think faith and religious music, you can often get, obviously you're attracted to the sense of the sacred, the sense of the spiritual, but sometimes when a piece of music lets rip with absolute joy, with the joy of eternal life and with the joy of singing, actually, and this recording has Julianne Baird as a wonderful soprano in a Joshua Rifkin recording. And I remember first hearing it and thinking, I didn't know music could be that thrilling.
Shout for joy to God in all lands.
Oh,
Joshua Rifkin directing Julianne Baird and the Bach Ensemble in the 1986 performance of the cantata BWV 51 by Johann Sebastian Bach. We were talking, James Runcie, about the fact that your father was an archbishop, or first a bishop and then archbishop when you were growing up, and your mother was a pianist and piano teacher. So quite a potent mixture of religion and music in your childhood.
Yes, well, religion was voluntary and music was compulsory. So I had to learn the piano and the clarinet. And the piano was playing, my mother was a teacher and taught at home, so the piano was in service most of the day. And that was considered absolutely the centrepiece of the house, the piano. And obviously the church was detached, although we always had a bedroom that was a chapel. So the spare bedroom was a chapel as well. So we always had that strange, heady mixture of God and music, yes. And my sister and I were brought up with both of these things sort of continually, because my father ran a theological college and some of the trainee vicars would stay in our house, would lodge with us. And whenever they were in danger of failing an exam, they would take me out to play football, hoping they'd get extra marks for their pastoral care. So there were some attentive priests. And I suppose there's also the flamboyance of church and music, the fact that theatre emerged from the church, and there is a terrible urge to perform if you live up in that kind of household. There's a terrible feeling that you have to somehow be an example. You look at your father who's preaching to a captive audience, you look at your mother who's performing, and obviously that influences you to feel that either you give up or you start showing off yourself. You know, there's an urge to perform, and you have to earn somebody listening to you. You have to earn people's response, actually. So is your job to be interesting somehow? You feel that you must be interesting. You must never be boring. That's the great sin.
We're going to hear Schubert's Impromptu number 1 in C minor now, which I think your mother used to play.
My mother played all the impromptus, and she performed them quite a lot. And it was always interesting to hear them performed because they were about the only time I could hear them played straight through, because when she was practising, it's very, very hard to listen to Schubert impromptus without imagining or remembering my mother breaking down with great cries of bugger. Particularly about 5 minutes into the first impromptu, the left hand gets very busy. And she always struggled with that. And the second impromptu is with some very speedy bits. So I was used to get interested in her frustration. But the idea of that, the idea of going back and practicing the same passage over and over, was incredibly good training for a writer, where you have to rehearse and look over the same passage until the rhythm of the prose is right. And it's practicing rhythm. I think the rhythm of this piece, the great announcing chord, and then the way it flows from its initial announcement, is in the way, the same way you should start a novel, I think, with an announcement of this is what I'm talking about, this is where I'm going.
We'll hear Alfred Brendel playing without the interjections your mother added. Alfred Brendel, playing music from Schubert's Impromptu No. 1 in C minor from his four impromptus, Deutsch 899. A piece your mother played. You know, one always imagines that the wife of the Archbishop of Canterbury, or indeed of any prelate, is a rather gentle, subservient character. That's not exactly a description of your mum, is it?
No, not at all. She was quite rebellious, and she believed in standing her ground and being as entertaining and almost competitive with my father at some points, which is often a losing battle. But she was determined to be her own woman and not play that typical role that's expected of a vicar's wife. And I suppose an early feminist. And she got a lot of stick for this, of course, because she was supposed to be a sort of free add-on, a sort of buy one, get one free kind of figure. And she was never having any of that. Also because when she went into parties or events and everything, nobody really wanted to speak to her. They just wanted to speak to my dad. And it's quite depressing going to a place where nobody really wants to speak to you, or you're the compensatory, you know, you're the number two. And she just didn't want to do that. So we were all a bit, you know, competitive, I suppose.
Well, I was going to say, that competition you've spoken about, it's interesting, competition between her and your father, but was there competition between you and your father?
Yes, very much so. Yes, he really did have to be the centre of attention, but he was graced with sort of this religious aura, which kind of covered over the performative element, I suppose.
Well, I was going to say, how have those experiences translated into the way you deal with your own children? You've got two daughters, haven't you?
Yes. Well, not brilliantly. I mean, not brilliantly all the time. I have a stepdaughter and a daughter, and people always say, you know, that must be difficult. And actually, you treat them both in different ways. And I suppose my relationship with my younger daughter, Charlotte, is more fiery. And I can hear her saying, Dad, don't talk about me. Don't bring me. You're always embarrassing when you talk about me. So I better not talk about Charlotte. But yet she's a writer too, and a better writer than I am, I think. But we have quite feisty, straightforward conversations. My stepdaughter's a bit more accommodating, I think. But even saying that word would get me into trouble with both daughters, actually. Mm. So any kind of opinion and any kind of showing off is, I think they're vaguely proud of me. But of course, one of the principal duties of a parent is to be embarrassing.
Music next, which takes you back to your early days. It's from the Bach French Suites, and you particularly wanted Joanna McGregor playing.
Well, Joanna McGregor is one of my oldest friends. Probably she is actually my oldest friend. I've known her since she was 15. And this was actually quite complicated to begin with, because she came to the house and played on my mother's piano. And that went down quite badly to begin with, because she was so good. And my mother
was the competitor.
My mother was sort of furious at how good she was. In fact, my mother started hoovering to try and drown the sound of Joanna playing.
Well, let's hear the Sarabande then from the Suite number 5. Played by Joanna McGregor without a Hoover.
Thank you.
Joanna McGregor playing the Sarabande from the French Suite No. 5 in G by Johann Sebastian Bach, a work that Bach began for his second wife, Anna Magdalena, probably as a wedding present. Let's talk a little bit about Grantchester, James Runcie, your series of novels, which have become a very popular television series, though I know you don't write the TV series anymore. But the setting is an England still recovering from the war. And in your novel, The Road to Grantchester, you describe very vividly what it was like for the young hero Sidney Chambers to serve in the war in Italy. That, I imagine, was based on your father's wartime experience?
Yes, it was. Although my father's experience was in Normandy, I moved it for fictional purposes to Italy because I wanted Monte Cassino to be in it and an attack on a monastery to make it a bit more dramatic. But I did use my father's wartime experience and that of his friend, Peter Balfour, whose letters I was given by his widow. And Peter was wounded in Normandy, and I used that wound, the way he was wounded in the novel, so Sidney gets wounded in the same way. So, yes, I did do that, and I wanted, obviously, this is partly about the toughness of faith, that faith is, when I was growing up, there was a lot of comedy vicars on television, Dick Emery, and vicars always had high voices or false teeth. That's basically what they had. And I wanted to say that it's much more serious than that, and that often a lot of faith is grounded in grief and the seeing and the witnessing of suffering and coming out of the war, and it's quite hard earned. And The Shadow of Death, which is the first title in the series, is not just the shadow of a death of a funeral, it's the shadow of the whole of the Second World War that falls over English and British civilization. So I wanted to talk about how you recover, and I wanted to make faith a bit more muscular and hard-earned than sometimes the over-tolerant, wishy-washy reception that the way in which the Church of England is perceived.
The priest wrestles with problems of religious faith and how to live a good life. And I wonder whether you wish, or maybe you do have, strong religious faith.
No, I don't have strong religious faith. I have incredible doubt. I have no problem with the poetry of faith. I have no problem with the Bible as literature. I have no problem with parables, the storytelling. I have problems with literalness. I have problems with the physical resurrection of the body. I have two problems, it's very clear. I mean, I have other personal problems, obviously, but I have two problems with faith. One is the physical resurrection of the body, and the other is the presence of evil in the world. I always had a trouble with that, but I've never had what a conversion experience. Two of my friends have, and they've had this. One of them described as being flooded by grace. I have never had that, so I don't know what that's like. And maybe I haven't opened my heart enough. I'm accused of not opening my heart enough, being some old cynic, you know, and that if I only opened my heart, the grace would flood in. But I did try, perhaps not hard enough for grace to flood in, and I'm afraid grace didn't come. But it comes through music, and I think that the joy that music brings and the redemptive power of music is something that's often quite enough for me.
Love and marriage and Ella Fitzgerald next, because they came together for you, didn't they?
They did, yes. Well, When I was 25, I went to Scotland and I met Marilyn, my wife, and she was a great fan of jazz and a great fan of Ella Fitzgerald. And I'm a Manchester City fan, and Blue Moon is their anthem. And I was also directing Harvey and the Wallbangers, a band at the time, and Blue Moon was one of the songs they sang. So Blue Moon is a sort of coming together of Marilyn, Harvey and the Wallbangers, and Manchester City Football Club, all in 3.5 minutes.
Just what I was there saying a prayer for someone I really could care for. And then there suddenly appeared before me the only one my arms will ever hold. I heard somebody whisper, "Please adore me." And when I looked, the moon had turned to gold. Blue moon, now I'm no longer alone, without a dream in my heart, without a love of my own. Then there suddenly appeared before me the only one my arms will ever hold. I heard somebody whisper, "Please adore me." And when I looked, the moon had turned to gold. Now I'm no longer alone, without a dream in my heart, without a love of my
Ella Fitzgerald and the Buddy Bregman Orchestra with Blue Moon, a Rodgers and Hart song from 1934. We'll be coming back to talk about your wife, Marilyn Imrie, and the memoir you've just written about her and what it was like caring for her when she had motor neurone disease. But I want to ask you now, James, about your exploration of the St. Matthew Passion, which has led to both a novel and a radio play. I wonder what it was about the writing of the Passion that so caught your imagination.
I made a film about Bach for BBC Two in the late 90s, and I was very struck by how wonderful it was to live amidst this music and study it with wonderful performers. And then Marilyn went to, my wife went to a meeting at Radio 4, and they said, we need some big thing for Easter. And she just said very casually, "Well, James will write a play about the St. Matthew Passion," and came home and said, "They seem quite interested in this." And I said, "But I haven't had any intention of writing a play about the St. Matthew Passion. What are you doing?" She said, "Well, it's your favourite piece of music. Why don't you get on with it?" And I had no idea how to do it. But what I did want to do was look at it from the point of view of a working musician. I thought that would be interesting, to look at the nuts and bolts of its creation rather than divine inspiration, man of genius, touched by God. Mm. I couldn't believe that it was just that. I believed in what it would be like to be a working musician. And one thing I do know about is rehearsals. And I know, because of theatre and because of making films, I know what that's like. I know the dread of disaster. I know the feeling that, oh my goodness, we've only got 3 weeks or we've only got 6 weeks to make this. And I thought if I could translate that into a kind of fly-on-the-wall documentary, as it were, about Leipzig in 1727, then that might be interesting. And the other thing I do know about is being at a boys' boarding school, and Bach is like head of music at a boys' school with 55 pupils, their dormitories. I know about bullying in dormitories. I know about dodgy food. I know about teachers who are borderline certifiable. You know, this kind of mad things. And to have that, and to have the close proximity of all these boys, all these families, all these issues, and to try and create art amidst it. I was interested in how do you find a way through the maelstrom? How do you find a defining thing about love, grief, death, and eventually redemption? And so how do you practically make that work?
Did you use documentary evidence when you came to write Bach's character?
Well, the Bach Reader was the absolute Bible for me. All the surviving documents from his life, including his will, which I found very helpful, all his possessions, all his musical instruments. A lot of his letters are actually complaints about not being taken seriously enough, and they're often about money and not being paid enough. And they're rather lovely recommendations for his students to get jobs, so CVs, references, you know. There's not very much about the art of composition. I like his definition of some of his pupils. You know, he divides them into ready, not quite ready, and useless. There's something rather practical about him, and I wanted to imagine him as a man, and I suppose this is where my parents come in again, because there's faith and music absolutely interlinked. And he obviously had to write a cantata a week, apart from in Lent, where he has 40 days to put together the St. Matthew Passion. And so the idea of putting together this great piece against a deadline, possibly writing for voices or musicians he knows, the oboist particularly, you know, writing beautiful pieces for the oboe da caccia. So that idea of what might that be like, to try and create that world, was very attractive. Also, the other thing is that I didn't think that both the play and the novel would take 5 years. But the idea of living with that, rather than writing some contemporary novel about the Old Kent Road, was, you know, much more exciting, much more lovely to live and work with Bach and have the music, and you can listen to the music and pretend it's research.
Let's just hear a snatch of the radio play you wrote, The Great Passion, with Simon Russell Beale playing Bach.
Build, don't fight. Look at Christ with love and favour. Stop! What is it, Monsieur Schmidt?
It's difficult to be precise and stay together all the time.
Not if we work at it.
There are so many different entries.
It's hard music.
Nothing is too hard with practice. We must have as much faith in our music as we have in God himself. With time and proper application, it must be possible to do anything. We take the oratorio step by step and build it up brick by brick until it becomes a glorious church.
Simon Russell Beale as Bach, with John Butt directing the Dunedin Consort in the opening of the Matthew Passion. As you say, not always an easy man. Do you identify with him a bit?
Oh, yes. I mean, loss of temper, of course. I said that a bit too quickly. But yes, loss of temper, impatience, frustration, anger, not getting things right, not getting things right first time, all these kind of things. I do identify with that. Being passionate about the work that you're doing and wanting it to be as good as possible and being infuriated when it can't be right or when it's just the same as a piece of music being out of tune or somebody not being up to the job as when your paragraph isn't right in a novel and you think, why is this not right? Then you fix the paragraph and then the paragraphs either side of it are no good. And you're full of rage sometimes when you're writing, but that's okay because complacency is the enemy. I mean, complacency is disastrous for any creative person, just to think, oh, this is really rather good. I think I'll write more like this. That's a disaster.
Well, let's hear some of the Matthew Passion. We've been talking about it in such detail. What have you chosen?
Well, I've chosen this aria, Marke Dich, sung by Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau, because obviously there are many arias to choose from the St. Matthew Passion, Erbarmer Dich being the most obvious. But there's something about this idea of cleansing, make my heart pure, that I find it makes me very, very tearful. And it comes very late on in the St. Matthew Passion, and it's a kind of summary of, it's that appeal to the individual sinner, the individual person who, what I love about the St. Matthew Passion is that the fact that it operates on both a grand scale and an intimate scale, and that the chorus can be both, rather like in a Greek tragedy, the chorus can be both observers and utterly involved. And this idea that you can take this enormous story into your own individual heart and try to be cleansed by it, I find amazingly moving.
And this recording is not a modern one by any means, but you obviously have a great affection for it.
Well, I have a great affection for Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau, partly because of my mother adoring him, and so I was brought up with the sound of his voice. But there is a wonderful version by the Dunedin Concert with Matthew Brooks singing it. But I wanted this because it reminds me of my childhood, and there's something about Fischer-Dieskau's voice. The pace is much more stately, and there's something very serious about it, something, dare we say, German about it. It's the Richter recording, which is much, much slower than modern recordings.
Large orchestra, vibrato.
Big, big orchestra, not traditional instruments, not old instruments, not one to a part. It's old, big, scaly stuff, you know, and it's magisterial, and yet this voice soars over it in the most intimate and personal way.
Ich will Jesus selbst begraben. Mache dich mein Herz rein, ich will Jesus selbst begraben. Ich will Jesus selbst begraben.
No. das Jesum ein, wählt geh aus, lass Jesum ein. Ich will Jesum selbst begraben. Mache dich mein Herz rein, ich will Jesum selbst begraben. Ich will Jesum selbst begraben.
Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau with that wonderful music from the St. Matthew Passion by Bach. Carl Richter conducting the Munich Bach Orchestra. It's the final aria where Joseph of Arimathea buries Jesus.
Yes, it's always... Everyone talks about a Barmadic being the moment where you cry, but I always cry at this bit. So it's very hard to talk about because I remember... You know, my wife holding my hand and knowing I was going to cry. So it's... But you kind of want to cry as well because you've got to let all the emotion that you've been through, all that suffering and all that beauty come out of you somehow and somewhere because it has to be released. And that is perhaps the glory of this piece of music because it enables you to feel thoughts... what Wordsworth called too deep for tears. And then, of course, the tears do come. And it's something remarkable and profound and challenging and takes you a long time to recover from, but you're glad you did it.
You are sadly no stranger to grief, James. As we mentioned, your wonderfully talented drama director wife, Marilyn, died in 2020 of motor neurone disease. And you've written a memoir about her, which will be published in November. One of the most moving sections is all about playing music to her towards the end.
Yes. Well, this is obviously very hard to talk about, but because at the end she couldn't speak, because motor neurone disease is literally an unspeakable disease because you lose the power of speech and you can't communicate. But one way of communicating was through music, so I would play her our favourite pieces, including... the funny thing is, of course, the St. Matthew Passion as a step is too difficult, really. Mm. So it was opera and piano music and Caffaro, some Handel, some Purcell, Dido and Aeneas, that's always about when I'm laid in earth. Oh, God, maybe this is a mistake. And we were able, so the decline was 6 months. She had it for a year, we think, probably longer. But there was enough time to plan her memorial service and to talk about the music she would like and her favourite music and the performers she would like. So music was a discussion through her illness and was a great help through it. I can't say it was a total help because obviously it's the most horrible, horrible disease and the most horrible thing. And she never wanted, she didn't want to die, you know. And people, we talk about resignation and everything. We didn't have any of that, actually. So it was a battle. But even these words are cliches, aren't they? Yeah. People battle with cancer. Well, it's sort of. But there's nothing, there is, of course, no language to describe it, which is where music comes in again, because you can't describe it. And it's very hard to communicate with somebody who can't speak back to you.
But you didn't want to end with a piece that cast us all down, which I think is typical of your character. You want to end with one of the pieces which brings joy, and I imagine that's something from what you've written, which was very much permeated your life with your wife.
Well, we were married for 35 years, and I thought the memorial service could be very bleak, and she wanted it to be thankful, and she wanted to be present at it and promised to be at it, which, of course, in many ways, she was, and she's still very much in my life. But I thought I wanted thankfulness to be part of it. I wanted grace and thankfulness. She was a very, very cheerful person, and she wouldn't want people to go out of that feeling bleak. Because it was fantastic that she lived at all. Fantastic that we had 35 years. It was absolutely amazing. She was an amazingly brilliant, wonderful, lovely woman. So you wanted to honour that. And so I thought, and I heard in the middle of all this grief, because it was, because of COVID, it was over a year before the memorial service, I thought of the music and I thought of what we would do. And Carolyn Sampson, who I know, I just... She said, are you all right? How are you? And she said, I'm doing this concert at the Wigmore Hall. And I turned it on and heard her sing. And I thought, she has to come to the memorial service and I have to persuade her to sing. And I thought about Purcell's Evening Hymn, which ends with this enormous Alleluia, as the Cantata 51 ends, which we've started this programme, ends with this Alleluia. And I thought, well, let's end with an Alleluia and a round of applause. We had that theatrical round, a minute of applause and whooping. But let's have something really graceful, really thankful and beautiful and astoundingly celebratory, because that's what life should be.
Well, James Rudsey, thank you very much. And we will say goodbye with the Purcell Evening Hymn sung by Carolyn Sampson. Thank you, James.
Thank you. It's total, total pleasure.
Thank you.
Carolyn Sampson with Purcell's An Evening Hymn. The Theorba was played by Elizabeth Kenny. And that was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions today, James Runcie. The episode was produced by Elizabeth Burke and it was a Loftus Media production for BBC Radio 3. And you can find details of all today's music if you search for Private Passions on BBC Sounds, where you can also download hundreds of previous editions. Michael returns next Sunday at noon when his guest will be the psychotherapist Gwen Adshead. BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and on BBC Sounds. It's 1 o'clock and time read for the news read by me, Jane Royce. King Charles is due to welcome more Commonwealth leaders at Buckingham Palace in the next hour, as the final preparations are being put in place for Queen Elizabeth's state funeral tomorrow. He's just held a meeting with the Prime Minister, Liz Truss, and this evening the King and Camilla, the Queen Consort, will host a reception for international dignitaries. People hoping to travel to London to file past the late Queen's coffin have been advised not to set off to avoid disappointment because the queue will close at some point today. There'll be a national one-minute silence at 8 o'clock tonight. Downing Street says Liz Truss will stand on the doorstep of No. 10 to mourn and reflect on the life and legacy of Queen Elizabeth. Prince Andrew has paid his first public tribute to his late mother. In a statement, the Duke of York said it had been an honour and privilege to serve her and described her devotion and personal service to the nation as unique and singular. In other news, police say they have a plan in place today to try to prevent a repeat of violent disorder in Leicester last night. Hundreds of people, mainly men from Hindu and Muslim communities, had to be separated. Two arrests were made. There have been a series of disturbances in recent weeks, initially sparked by a test cricket match between India and Pakistan at the end of last month. High winds and heavy rain from one of Japan's most powerful typhoons in decades are battering the southern island of Kyushu. In some areas, more than a month's worth of rain's already fallen. Several million people have been urged to head for emergency shelters. Hundreds of flights have been cancelled. 27 people have been killed in a bus crash in China's Guizhou province. 20 others were injured. Local media is reporting that the bus was being used to transport people to and from coronavirus quarantine. That hasn't been confirmed by local officials. The executive arm of the European Union has recommended suspending around €7.5 billion in funding for Hungary unless it addresses concerns about alleged corruption. The Hungarian government is suspected of using EU development money to enrich its political allies. Hungary's Prime Minister, Viktor Orbán, denies that his country is any more corrupt than others in the EU. And today's weather, mainly cloudy across the UK with breaks allowing for some sunny spells today. A few scattered showers are likely, but the southwest will stay drier. BBC News at 2 minutes past one.
Night Tracks with me, Hannah Peel, and Sarah Moore Peach. A space to relax, tune out everyday life, and really listen.
Come with us on an immersive adventure in sound. Together, we'll weave through a millennium of music, from works on the cutting edge to sonorous medieval chant, following wherever our ears take us.